More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Thank you.
Good evening and welcome to Gremlin Time. This is Fortunato. Let's see, tonight we're going to be a little bit different. I actually had a strange month and I just couldn't come up with a new story to present or produce. And I was thinking of putting out a repeat today. But then, you know, I started thinking about the last few months. You've been reading the nonfiction work about the history of the comedians. And a few weeks ago on the Monday Sampler, D.K. Holm and I interviewed the author of this very nice biography of one of America's great film directors. The author's name is Alan K. Rohde, and this director had done one of the great movies of American cinema. And so I'm going to read the chapter from this book about the production of that movie. And I am, of course, talking about Michael Curtiz and the movie Casablanca. Success has many fathers, and none more so than Casablanca, the most enduringly popular movie in cinema history. From Jack Warner and Hal Wallace tussling over the 1944 Best Picture Oscar to both men claiming exclusive credit for creation of the film in their memoirs, to the different screenwriters and other participants weighing in with their varying recollections, and the numerous books and essays detailing and debunking every possible aspect of the film, one thing remains certain. Decades later, everybody involved with the making of Casablanca still wanted to come to Rick's. Despite the voluminous historiography, Casablanca remains worthy of re-examination. The film was the product of some of the best Hollywood talent of 1942, working at peak pitch on what was thought to be just another picture. Shortly before producing his final film, Rooster Cogburn, in 1975, Hal Wallace remarked about Casablanca, "We started out to make a good picture. We never dreamed it would become a classic." The morning of December 8th, 1941, when America declared war and Michael Curtiz began production on Yankee Doodle Dandy, Stephen Carnot, a Warner Brothers story analyst, read the play Everybody Comes to Rick's and sent a summary and a detailed 22-page synopsis to Wallace 3 days later. Carnot was precedent about the cinematic possibilities: excellent melodrama, colorful, timely background, tense mood, suspense, psychological and physical conflict, tight plotting, sophisticated hokum. A box office natural for Bogart or Cagney or Raff in Out of Unusual Roles, and perhaps Mary Astor, unquote. Irene Lee, Wallace's story editor, had discovered the unproduced play on a trip to New York and recommended that Wallace buy it. This is borne out by archival records and the recollections of the screenwriter Julius Epstein. After Wallace approved the $20,000 purchase, a hefty sum for an unproduced play, Lee is said to have given the initial screenplay assignment to the Epstein brothers. The notion that she did this on her own authority is specious. Wallace zealously reserved the right to select the writers to create screenplays for his films. Lee certainly could have recommended the Epsteins to Wallace. Irene Lee, later Irene Lee Diamond, would survive all the Casablanca principles and maintained her claim to be the person who initially saw the play's potential as a movie. According to Lee, Wallace remained in character after Casablanca became a huge hit. In addition to claiming credit for discovering Everybody Comes to Rick's, he responded to her request for a modest bonus with a dismissive, "That's what you're here for." Though Lee admired Wallace's considerable abilities as a producer, their relationship also reportedly included an affair. She had little choice but to accept her status as a highly competent female employee working in a male-dominated industry. It was an inequitable situation exacerbated by Wallace's reluctance to share credit with anyone. There is also an assertion by the screenwriter Casey Robinson that he read Everybody Comes to Rick's during a train trip to New York with Wallace and urged him to buy the play. Robinson's substantial contributions to Casablanca were significant, but this is one of several claims that remain unverifiable. Murray Bennett and Joan Allison wrote the play Everybody Comes to Rick's. Burnett's inspiration came during a trip to Europe in 1938. The virulent anti-Semitism in Vienna significantly altered Burnett's outlook about the coming war. He also visited a French nightclub with a black piano player and was inspired to create Rick's Cafe and the Sam character. 30 years after the film was released, Burnett took legal umbrage against Casablanca screenwriter Howard Koch. Koch had dismissed the play as having little or nothing to do with the film and assumed credit for the motivations of nearly all of the film's principal characters. He also dismissed the play as having had little or nothing to do with the film. He made these claims in the April 1973 edition of New York Magazine and in the foreword to his book Casablanca, Script and Legend, published the same year. Burnett sued everybody involved. Koch later apologized and admitted that Burnett's complaint was justified. Even so, Burnett lost his defamation lawsuits. The challenge of attributing specific creative contributions to Casablanca is primarily due to the fact that at least 7 different writers worked on it separately, with the exception of the Epstein brothers, who always worked together. Despite Koch's assertion that he worked with the Epsteins for 10 days on the script, there is no formal or informal record of the various Casablanca writers ever collaborating directly with each other. The progression of the script was analogous to the manufacture of a bicycle wheel. Wallace was at the hub, adding the different writers as spokes. The balance of the writing mostly involved shaping the motivations and behaviors of the key characters, rather than broad plot reconstructing. Burnett and Alice's play remained the spine of the film. By the time the Epsteins began to write the Casablanca screenplay in mid-February 1942, Hal Wallace's role at the studio had changed, as he had signed a new contract with Jack Warner on January 12th. His new contract specified that, quote, a Hal Wallace production, unquote, or, quote, produced by Hal Wallace, unquote, should appear after the film's main title in a size that left no doubt whose picture it was. The contract gave him carte blanche with respect to actors, scripts, directors, and technical and production staff to produce 4 Warner films per year. The 4 films would later be renegotiated to 6. In addition to a lavish weekly salary, he was entitled to 10% of the gross profits after each picture realized 125% of its cost. Wallace initially believed that he'd finally reaped his due benefits after decades of successful toil at Warner Brothers, but he had encroached on Jack Warner's narrow boundary of tolerance concerning the perception of who ran the studio. The once close relationship between the pair became a ticking time bomb. As the Epstein twins began work on the script, Wallace sent an outline to William Wyler in Sun Valley, where he was vacationing and playing gin rummy with Daryl Zanuck. After not receiving any interest from either Wyler or Sam Goldwyn for a loan of the director, Wallace sent the play to Curtiz, William Knightley, and Vincent Sherman. Sherman responded that he would love to direct Casablanca, but the producer opted for Curtiz. Curtiz was captivated by the dual concepts of the war and the relationship between Rick Blaine and Elsa Lund. He immersed himself in pre-production planning with Hal Wallace. Press reports concerning the possibilities of different actors appearing in Casablanca were primarily the result of the Warner publicity mills' placing phony plants in the trade papers and gossip columns. Ronald Reagan was never a serious contender to play Rick. Casablanca was designed specifically for Humphrey Bogart, as confirmed by Wallace's memo to Steve Trilling, head of casting department. With 9 years and 30 films under his belt at Warner Brothers, Bogart had finally established himself as a leading man. He starred in Across the Pacific, 1942, a war-themed reunion of the principal cast of The Maltese Falcon, which he was finishing when he was assigned to Casablanca. But he still needed a role as a romantic leading man to get him truly on top. Wallace decided that Casablanca would be the picture. A pair of memos exchanged by Wallace and Jack Warner disproves the oft-repeated myth of George Raft's being offered and turning down the role of Rick Blaine. Warner wrote to Wallace on April 2nd, quote, "Raft knows we're going to make it and is starting a campaign for it," unquote. Wallace's response, quote, "I have thought over very carefully the matter of George Raft in Casablanca, and I have discussed this with Mike, and we both feel that he should not be in the picture. Bogart is ideal for it, and it has been written for him, and I think we should forget Raft for this property. Incidentally, he hasn't done a picture here since I was a little boy, and I don't think he should be able to put his fingers on just what he wants to do when he wants to do it," unquote. Curtiz had avoided directing Raft, whom he considered a no-talent star. He respected Bogart as a highly professional performer, although he thought the actor never exhibited any inclination toward preparation. After Casablanca, Curtiz observed, quote, "Humphrey Bogart never studied, but he is always great," unquote. In his defense, Bogart hadn't required a lot of preparation during the long years of collapsing on Warner sound stages after being shot with blanks. Curtiz would direct Bogart differently from when the actor played heavies for him in Kid Galahad, 1937. And Virginia City, 1940. He allowed Bogart to find himself as Rick Blaine. Their professional relationship would evolve despite becoming strained by the end of the picture. Bogart loathed the director's verbal malice towards those who couldn't fight back. yet he had genuine appreciation for Curtis's abilities. When Bogart signed a landmark contract with Jack Warner in 1946, the document included directorial approval. He provided a list of five acceptable candidates: John Huston, Howard Hawks, John Cromwell, Delmer Davis, and Michael Curtiz. Casting Elsa Lund was a different matter. Wallace initially opted for Anne Sheridan, but that was when the character was still the trampy American called Lois Meredith, from Burnett's play. Someone advised Wallace to change Lois Meredith to Elsa Lund. It was apparently Casey Robinson who did the convincing. Robinson, Warner Brothers' highest-paid screenwriter, was extremely close to Wallace. He claimed in a 1974 interview that he, quote, got the idea to use not two Americans, but a European girl and an American, and to tie the story into World War II and the refugees. Robinson said that the notion of using a European woman occurred to him because he was falling in love with a Russian ballerina named Tamara Tomanova. Tomanova did receive an Elsa Lund screen test for Casablanca and married Casey Robinson in 1944. Robinson also stated that Wallace originally offered him Casablanca to write and was piqued that the producer then assigned the Epsteins to, quote-unquote, my picture. Robinson's recommendation of a foreigner to replace the Lewis Meredith character was relayed to the Epstein brothers, who responded from Washington, D.C. with their typical panache, quote, well, we handle the foreign situation here. You try to get a foreign girl for the part. An American girl with big tits will do. Love and kisses, Julie and Phil, unquote. After a request to borrow Hedy Lamarr was rebuffed by Louis B. Mayer, the French actress Michelle Morgan was tested, but was found wanting. Wallace began a dialogue with David O. Selznick for the services of Ingrid Bergman. As the script was very much a work in progress, Wallace sent the Epstein brothers to relate the story to Selznick's assistant, Dan O'Shea. The Epsteins ended up in front of Selznick, who was ensconced behind his desk during lunchtime, slurping down a bowl of soup. Julius Epstein realized that after droning on for about 20 minutes, he hadn't even mentioned Bergman. So I said, it's going to be a lot of shit like Algiers. And Selznick looked up and nodded to me that we had Bergman. After producing Rebecca in 1940, Selznick had become Hollywood's most prominent loan shark for contract talent. He rented out his stable of actors, which included Bergman, Vivian Leigh, Joan Fontaine, and the director, Alfred Hitchcock, at top-drawer prices above their salaries and pocketed the overage. These deals allowed Selznick to maintain his lavish lifestyle while staying ahead of his gambling losses. In addition to being paid $3,125 per week for an 8-week loan of Ingrid Bergman, David O. Selznick Productions received the services of Olivia de Havilland from Warner Brothers for the identical number of weeks and dollars. Selznick promptly lent out de Havilland to RKO for Government Girl so he could get paid again without having to produce a movie. Selznick maintained the right to take an acute interest in how Bergman would be photographed and dressed in Casablanca, and he sent several of his infamously long memoranda to Wallace on the subject. It was a part of an orchestrated plan to build up Bergman, whose film since Intermezzo, 1939, had been successful but unspectacular. Selznick hoped the Casablanca would be a major hit, as he had planned to lend Bergman to Paramount for an even bigger payday to co-star with Gary Cooper in For Whom the Bell Tolls. Bergman hadn't to have a clue what Casablanca was about, but she was immediately put at ease by Curtiz, who charmed her thoroughly. She later wrote, I greatly enjoyed Mike Curtiz, who really taught me quite a bit. Curtiz, likewise, admired Bergman's concentration. She was also refreshingly absent the movie star sense of entitlement. Curtiz called everyone baby, but he addressed Bergman as Christmas baby, meaning that she was extra special. There was no doubt that he was attracted to her, but his days of sleeping with his leading ladies were long gone. He satisfied himself with an alluringly platonic relationship during the production. In a candid moment, he reflected on his dealing with actors generally, and Bergman in particular. "I am very critical of actors, but if I find a real actor, I am first to appreciate it. I am very contemptuous to unreal things. I try to express myself real. It is very difficult to get down-to-earth results with actors who don't act at all. I'm not too much popularity, but I think Miss Bergman is my friend." Curtiz's mentorship of Bergman included his recommendation that she cease playing roles such as the governess in Adam Had Four Sons and the barmaid in Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, both from 1941. He advised that attempting to professionally stretch herself in Hollywood of the 1940s would end up limiting her career. In addition to being true to the audience, she had to be true to herself, and the Elsa Lund character was completely genuine. One of Curtiz's chief contributions to Casablanca was his enabling Humphrey Bogart to become a star while reminding Ingrid Bergman how to remain one. Curtiz wanted the Dutch actor Philip Dorn to play Victor Laszlo, but Dorn was already cast in Random Harvest, in production at Metro. He was adamant about having an appropriate European actor to match Bergman. Wallace warned him that he might have to settle for someone different. "I have been going over with Trilling the possibilities of the part of Laszlo, and aside from Philip Dorn, whom we cannot get, and Paul Hindred, who I am sure will not play the part when he reads it, there is no one else that I can think of. I think you should satisfy yourself at this point, that is, that there is no one available, and then begin to adjust yourself to the thought that we might have to use someone of the type of Dean Jagger, Ian Hunter, or Herbert Marshall, or someone of this type without an accent. I am as anxious as you are to have a type like Philip Dorn in the part. But if there is no one available, there is just nothing we can do about it." Paul Hindred initially believed that the Laszlo part was a loser and turned it down. But after being impressed while watching the rushes of Now Voyager, Wallace upped the ante to co-star billing with Bogart and Bergman and assumed the balance of Hindred's existing contract with RKO. Hindred accepted the part, but had misgivings about the picture was finished. After the picture was finished, he ended up getting the girl, but also not. Hindred brought the precise chord of noble integrity to the part of Victor Laszlo that proved integral in making Casablanca work. The rest of the cast fell into place. As the Sam character, Wallace briefly considered the jazz pianist and singer Hazel Scott, who he thought would be marvelous for the part, or Lena Horne instead of an African-American male actor. The notion was discarded because of the controversy that would ensue over a desirable woman of color being perceived as possibly having a romantic relationship with Rick Blaine. Casting a woman in the role would also detract from the love affair between Rick and Elsa. Upon further review, it was deemed more acceptable for Bogart to have a black male companion. After initially ordering Steve Trilling to sign Clarence Muse to portray Sam, Wallace acceded to Curtiz by casting the drummer-singer Arthur Dooley Wilson instead. Wallace tepidly termed Wilson's screen test pretty good, but Curtiz believed he was markedly superior Clarence Muse, whose acting struck the director as stereotypical. The pianist, Elliot Carpenter, the only other African-American on set, played the piano just off camera while Wilson fingered the keys. In addition to As Time Goes By, Wilson's voice was used for it had to be you, Shine, and Knock on Wood. The critical accolades Wilson received for his portrayal of Sam validated Curtiz's faith in him. Curtis and Wallace both surmised that Claude Rains would be perfect as Captain Renault. The Epstein brothers revered Rains and ended up writing their most delightfully sarcastic dialogue for him. Julius Epstein later admitted that he and his brother initially couldn't understand why Wallace and Curtiz didn't use a French actor instead of Rains. But the Casablanca would never have become what it is without Claude Rains. Conrad Veidt, a major silent film star who played the somnambulist in The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari in 1920, proved similarly ideal as Major Strasser. Veidt was a passionate anti-Nazi with a Jewish wife who fled Hitler's Germany and became recounseled to playing Hollywood Nazis in order to make a living. Otto Preminger was tested for the Strasser role, but would have to wait another decade to prepare to portray a memorable Nazi in Billy Wilder's Stalag 17, 1953. According to Julius Epstein, Curtiz urged Veidt to finesse the Strasser character into an aristocratic villain rather than a stereotypical Nazi thug. Peter Lorre and Sidney Greenstreet were added as Ugatti and Ferrari. Greenstreet was already under contract, and Wallace borrowed Lorre from Universal. Both Greenstreet's and Lorre's roles are small, but their kinetic ability to captivate audiences made them prominent. The Ferrari role was built up, along with Greenstreet's salary, to make the corpulent actor congenial toward the smallish part. The corrupt aura of his sinister bulk, adorned in a fez and wielding a fly swatter, a Curtiz touch, added considerable and literal heft to the picture. Peter Lorre was the knuckleball of Hollywood character actors. Curtiz was never fully certain what he might utter when the cameras rolled, except that it was bound to be excellent. With protruding eyes and a murmuring voice like a sinister Cupid doll, he famously played the child murderer in Fritz Lang's M, 1931, the Japanese detective Mr. Moto, and the effete Joel Cairo in The Maltese Falcon. Lorre's subtle brilliance concealed a disastrous morphine addiction that eventually destroyed him. An inveterate practical joker, he provided comic relief on the set by surreptitiously extinguishing Curtiz's cigarettes with water from an eyedropper. According to Paul Hendren, Lorre hooked up a microphone that picked up the live action of a Curtiz lunchtime trias behind the soundstage flats, to the immense enjoyment of several members of the cast. The story is probably apocryphal, as production records indicate that Heinrich and Lorre were never on the set of Casablanca at the same time. Memorable lines that became embedded in popular culture included "Round up the usual suspects," "I am shocked to learn that gambling is going on in here," and "The Germans wore gray, you wore blue," were the creations of the Epstein brothers, who would be paid for 12 weeks as the principal screenwriters. "Here's looking at you, kid," was either an Epstein inspiration or a Bogart ad lib that was incorporated into the script. And the most famous of all, "Play it again, Sam," was never in the script or uttered by Bogart in the film. The screenwriters didn't have an easy time working with Curtiz, whose story conception often relied on his mind's eye as the camera, building the picture scene by scene. During the studio system era, story continuity was the writer's principal consideration, and Warner Brothers screenwriters rarely were allowed to visit a set. That John Huston was allowed to write and direct The Maltese Falcon was a rare exception. Jack Warner ran his studio with a specific individual assigned to every function of the movie-making process. His blood pressure rose precipitously whenever someone had the temerity to attempt to change the role that he, as the head of the studio, had designated for him or her. Julius Epstein recalled the process of working with Curtiz on Casablanca. Curtiz was marvelous on the visual side of directing. He knew just when the cigarette smoke should curl backwards, when to move, when not to move. We all knew, of course, that the night before the story conferences, Mike would get his directions regarding the script development from his wife, Bess Meredith, who was one of the great silent screen writers, and then come in and tell us what Bess had said. But sometimes Mike would forget what to say. I wish I had a tape recording of those story conferences. John Meredith Lucas had a similar memory of Curtiz telling Epstein that he was displeased with a certain scene in Casablanca. When asked for specific, the director scowled and said, "God damn it, I don't remember what hell Bess told me." Cassie Robinson elaborated about Curtiz and screenwriters. "I think Mike was one of the great directors of scenes. He knew nothing whatever about the story. He didn't get along with writers because he couldn't talk to them, you know. He didn't know what the hell you were talking about. He saw it in pictures, and you supplied the stories." To be fair, the notion of Curtiz's alleged inability to comprehend story continuity doesn't take into consideration that the Casablanca screenplay was continually being rewritten during the entire production. Curtiz acted several times to restore equilibrium to what he perceived to be an unbalanced script, although Curtiz and Wallace thought that the initial Epstein script was superbly written. They both believed it was incomplete. Who was Rick Blaine? What was his background? How did he end up owning a Casablanca saloon? To address this, Howard Koch was assigned to write an entirely new screenplay after meeting with Curtiz and Wallace on April 6. Koch incorporated his political views into the script. Liberalism combined with anti-fascism was a mainstream sentiment in the Hollywood of 1942. Rick was molded into a closet idealist, a sentimentalist, as Captain Renault termed it. In one scene penned by Koch, Renault remarks that Rick ran guns to Ethiopia and supported the loyalist side in Spain, implying that Blaine was a member of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade that fought Franco during the Spanish Civil War. After Blaine parries that he was well paid for his work, Renault provides the touche, "The winning side would have paid you more." Other polemics by Koch made Rick much more than a cynical saloonkeeper nursing a broken heart. Blaine jokingly warns Major Strasser that the Third Reich would be well advised to stay out of certain areas of New York. Koch even provided Sidney Greenstreet's Ferrari with a line about the futility of isolationism. He also added the vignette of Rick arranging to have the young Bulgarian girl and her husband, played by Jack Warner's stepdaughter Joy Page and Helma Dantin, win at roulette in order to purchase an exit visa so that she won't have to sleep with Captain Renault. Koch claimed in his memoir that the memory of his wife being allowed to win at Palm Springs Casino by a compassionate croupier inspired this scene. In a rebuttal to Koch's oft-fabulistic recollections, Casey Robinson averred that Curtiz was the creator of the roulette exit visa scenario. Curtiz expressed concern that the love story between Rick and Elsa was getting lost amid the Epstein brothers' Weisenheimer humor and Koch's speechifying. Wallace agreed and had the screenwriters Lenore Coffey and Casey Robinson review the script. Coffey wrote an alternative and ultimately unused storyline in less than a week before Wallace took her off salary. Robinson generated a detailed 7-page memorandum on May 20th, 5 days before Curtiz started shooting, that significantly shaped the final element of the story. "My impression about Casablanca is that the melodrama is well done, the humor excellent, but the love story deficient. Therefore, my comments are almost all concerned with the latter." Robinson suggested a number of changes to the script that would be incorporated into the final version. One key addition was a solitary entrance of Elsa into Rick's cafe and her insistence that Sam play As Time Goes By to emphasize the symbolism of the song to the Rick-Elsa love affair. His other recommendations, including the meeting between Elsa and a drunken, bitter Rick in the darkened cafe, and the sequence in which Elsa explains why she left Rick and how she venerates her husband. He also clarified the somewhat ambiguous relationship between Elsa and Victor Laszlo. Robinson concluded by laying out the dynamics that would end the picture on an emotional high note. Now you're really set up for a swell twist when Rick sends her away on the plane with Victor. For now, in doing so, he is not just solving a love triangle, he is forcing the girl to live up to the idealism of her nature, forcing her to carry on with the work that in those days is far more important than the love of two little people. It is something that we'll both be glad for when the pain is over. Curtiz began filming Casablanca on Monday morning, May 25th, 1942, on stage 12A, sporting a bandaged right hand from a Sunday afternoon polo injury. He had received his usual pretentious messages from Jack Warner the previous Friday. "These are turbulent days, and I know you will finish Casablanca in top 7 weeks. I am depending on you to be the old Curtiz I know you to be, and I'm positive you are going to make one great picture." On his first day of shooting, Curtiz had a heated confrontation with the sound mixer, Francis Sheed. They despised one another, but often had to work together. Despite his resume of hits, Curtiz was not permitted to select the technicians for his assignments. The Warner Brothers production technical staff reported to Tenney Wright. Wright usually tried to please, but he was not going to foul up another picture of compromise his assignment schedule solely for the basis of Curtiz's whims. Apparently, not even Hal Wallace, armed with his new contract, could overrule Wright. Wallace had ordered Wright to assign James Wong Howe as a cinematographer for Casablanca, but he and Curtiz ended up with Arthur Edison because Howe had already committed to the hard way and Wright refused to move him. Curtiz had loathed sound mixers since the days of the early Vitaphone pictures, when he was required to kowtow to know-it-all Western Electric technicians. Over the years, he vented pressure on set by using the sound man as his verbal pinata. Sneed described Curtiz to L. Jean Harmetz as, quote, "a miserable bastard," unquote, who treated him with disdain during their half dozen pictures together. According to Sheed, Curtiz shot the first scene of Casablanca, a portion of the flashback love scene in a Paris cafe, in a low-ceiling set where he couldn't place a microphone. "I told him there was no way to put a mic in," he said. "Oh, shut up, you dumb sound man." After several line readings with a two-page scene, Sneed stopped the recording and told Curtiz that it sounded lousy. "He got red in the face, completely red in the face," he said. "To hell with you, to hell with you, to hell with you," he said, "to hell with you." You could have heard a pin drop as Shive stalked off the set. Expecting to be fired, Shive reported to work the next day. He discovered that Wallace had sent a memo that morning to George Groves, head of the sound department, complaining that the hum of a sun arc lamp ruined the scene and the delay in replacing the lamp prevented the scene from being shot. Wallace explained the incidents to Groves on the basis of what he'd been told by Curtiz. "My question to you is, why didn't the mixer hear the hum of the sun arc during the 12 rehearsals? Why didn't he speak up at the time, which would have given the company plenty of opportunity to replace the lamp while other rehearsals were taking place? As I understand it, the mixer's argument was that there were too many other noises for him to have heard the sun arc during the rehearsals. But this was not the case, as the scene was a very tender, delicate one, and Mike called for absolute quiet on the set." According to Sheed, Curtiz lied to Wallace about the episode with the microphone, making up the story of the defective sun arc lamp to cover himself for not having the scene completed. When Sheed walked onto the stage the next morning, Curtiz greeted him. I am sorry you got mad at me. Sheed, who would become a combat photographer during the war, never wavered in his version of the first day's events or his views of Curtiz as a cowardly bully. While Curtiz was butting heads with the sound recorder, Wallace was making life challenging for the veteran cinematographer Arthur Edison. A former portrait photographer, Edison began his film career in 1911 as a camera operator at the Eclair Studios in Fort Lee, New Jersey. His credits include The Thief of Baghdad, 1924, All's Quiet on the Western Front, 1929, Frankenstein, 1931, and Mutiny on the Bounty, 1935. More recently, he was behind the camera for The Maltese Falcon and Sergeant Reorke, both 1941. A diminutive pipe smoker nicknamed Little Napoleon, Edison was nearing retirement, but remained a formidable talent. He was one of the cinematographers who, before filming a scene, personally marked the actor's positions with a piece of chalk, adjusted the lights with the stand-ins in place, then darkened the chalk line so the actors knew exactly where their marks were. Curtiz and Edison got along fine, although there was the usual heartburn over work rapidity, as the production manager Al Allenborn noted. Edison and Mike are having their little argument now and then, but nothing serious. You know how Mike is. Edison's doing his damnedest, but he's not as fast as we would like him to be. Wallace initially took Edison to task for taking an hour and a half to light the cafe scene for the contentious initial scene that Curtiz never shot. He reminded the cinematographer, "You were present at all the meetings we had all about the war emergencies and the necessity of conserving money and material, and I asked you to sacrifice a little on quality if necessary in order not to take these long periods of time for setups." A written reminder from Wallace to minimize the amount of time required for camera setups was nothing new, but there was a fresh sense of urgency owing to the war. Since Pearl Harbor, the studio's culture of frugality had become a relentless campaign of penny-pinching. Jack Warner was particularly eager to use the war as an excuse for economies. The studio newspaper, the Warner Club News, carried an editorial exhorting all employees to save nails. "Without them, we cannot build sets. Without sets, it would be impossible to make pictures." Harry Warner gave a speech to employees with the theme, "Waste is more deadly than sabotage." The waste highlighted by the elder Warner specifically referred to the overuse of film stock. The translation, "If Curtiz and the other Warner directors shot too many takes, it was no longer simply a case of being wasteful, they were sabotaging the war effort." Jack Warner delivered a lecture to all the directors on the lot about the conservation of film stock. A memo from Jack to Curtiz near the end of the production nagged about minimizing the use of film. "Dear Mike, I can't understand why a 54-second take must be started 7 times. You must cut down on the amount of positive and negative film." The government's War Production Board had established price limits on building almost everything, including studio sets. Materials such as rubber and nylon were scarce. Rationing of gasoline and other commodities began in earnest by May 1942. Most skilled tradesmen left Warner Brothers because of the draft or better job opportunities in war-related industries than other studios. Yet the zealous practice of constantly scouring their business operations to save or recoup the most minuscule amounts of money would hold Warner Brothers in good stead during the war years. Nothing was overlooked. Curtiz receives an officious letter from Roy Oblinger on January 22, 1942, insisting that the studio's highest-paid director, at $3,600 per week, immediately remit $26.95 to settle an overdue bill for personal phone calls. Beyond the routine parsimony, the innovative cost reductions were realized on Casablanca. Wallace sent Curtiz a memo 10 days before the cameras rolled concerning set use. "We are building a portion of a railway station for now Voyager. I have an idea that it can be easily adapted for your railway station in the retrospect of the addition of a sign and a piece of railing, as suggested in the sketch you showed me the other day. Will you please look over the model or the plan, as we can take advantage of a good set without cost? Casablanca was not an expensive film. Nearly the entire picture was shot on studio sound stages and the Warner Lot's French Street. The sole location scene was Major Strauss's deplaning arrival, which was filmed at the Metropolitan Airport in nearby Van Ness. Curtiz finished at the airport in a single day and had a glass technician capture the matte background of Casablanca behind the plane on the tarmac. The original budget of $878,000 ended up increasing to slightly more than $1 million because of the salaries of the cast and the writers who worked throughout the production. Bogart received $36,667. Henrid and Bergman were paid $25,000 each. Raines got $4,000 per week with a 5-week guarantee. Veit, $5,000 per week for 5 weeks. And Greenstreet, $3,750 for 2 weeks. Much to Wallace's frustration, Greenstreet overran his 2-week guarantee and cost an additional salaried week. Curtiz received $73,400, considerably more than anyone else on the picture, including Wallace, although the producer's base salary didn't include the profit percentages that were a part of his new deal with Jack Warner. Wallace had his own ideas not only about what he wanted to see on screen, but how it should be accomplished. Another memo to Arthur Edison was specific about what he desired. I want to again ask you to get as much contrast as possible in lighting the picture, especially in the scenes in Rick's Cafe. I am anxious to get real blacks and whites, with the walls and the backgrounds in shadow and dim, sketchy lighting. The sensitive Edison was wounded by the criticism and didn't react the way Wallace requested. After viewing the dailies, Wallace followed up with Curtiz 2 days later. Again, I want to say that I don't think the cafe is dark enough. I think there is too much general lighting, and somehow or other the place doesn't seem to have the character to me that it should have. Either we should have something on the walls, some matting or decorations of some kind, or we should have a less general illumination. Everything is too generally lighted. The lighting memorandum illustrates Wallace's maturity as a creative producer. He knew exactly how Rick's Cafe should appear on screen, with shaded lighting through a haze of cigarette smoke and an absolute minimum of reflected light. A review of Wallace's communications throughout the production of Casablanca finds them to be civil, reasoned, and insightful. Casablanca would reflect a great deal of Wallace's personal vision, including the live parrot he had placed outside of the Blue Parrot Cafe. I'm sorry, I've lost my place. We're reading from the book on Michael Curtiz by Alan K. Rohde, and this is, I'm reading the section on the production of Casablanca. I don't know if I'm going to finish it in time. I'm just going to read until we run out of time here as we go on. And so, general illumination. But the producer never outstripped Curtis's own visualizations. The flourishes of Bergman knocking over the glass in the Paris Cafe, the Vichy water bottle hurled into the trash by Raines at the finale, and Bogart's curling cigarette smoke that precedes the flashback sequence underscore Curtiz's brilliance. One of Casablanca's most striking attributes is its exquisite imagery. Perhaps the most emblematic example is the initial interior sequence in Rick's Cafe. It is a visual panorama of waiters with trays, patrons, and soldiers all moving about or seated in crowded nightclub in a faultless choreography of bustle. The sequence transitions from a close-up of Dooley Wilson singing into a dolly shot that reveals the darkly lit interior before dissolving into a quick series of shots of shady black marketeers surreptitiously touting all manner of escape to a mixture of bewildered Europeans. One can't help wondering if Curtiz's formative years in Budapest cafes influenced his vision of Ricks, and it is more than his fluid camera movement and skilled composition that create the authenticity. The actors appear to be European refugees because, for the most part, they were. Many of the bit actors in Casablanca were expatriates who had fled the Nazis. Curtiz personally cast each of them. Many were Jewish refugees. One notable duo was Elke Gruning, who played Mrs. Leichtag, and Ludwig Strassel, a distant relative of the author, who portrayed her husband. Gruning was a 66-year-old Viennese actress, the oldest performer in the film, who appeared with Conrad Veidt in a 1919 German silent of Peter Gynt, made a trio of movies for F.W. Murnau, and worked with Max Reinhardt. She left Germany after the Nazis came to power and didn't work for nearly 9 years. Until appearing in Vincent Sherman's Underground, 1941, Stossel was an Austrian stage actor who transitioned into German films, including Fritz Lang's The Testament of Dr. Mabuse, 1932. He fled to the United States after the Auschwitz and forged a long career in Hollywood that included the short-lived Casablanca television series and a string of TV commercials wearing lederhosen as that little old winemaker for Italian Swiss Colony wine. Among the credited players was young Helmut Dante, the son of a prominent Austrian railroad executive. Dante had become a leading anti-Nazi agitator in Austria and organized youth riots before being interned in a concentration camp and eventually making his way to the United States. He became an actor who played Nazis in Random Harvest and Desperate Journey. There was also a refugee husband and wife team, Marcel Dalio, a French movie star who played the croupier who hands over the gambling winnings to Captain Renault, was married to Madeleine Lebleu, who was Rick's jilted girlfriend, starts a fight between a German officer and a French soldier in the cafe. All told, 34 nationalities appeared in the film. Although he eschewed the fisticuffs, Curtiz gleaned inspiration for the famous Marseillaise scene from his Dodge City of 1939 saloon fight, reusing the competing song concept, this time with French national's anthem, with the French national anthem drowning out Deutschland über alles sung by Major Strasser and his cabal. The gargantuan character actor Don Seymour, who played the doorman at the gambling den in Rick's, watched the crowd of actors on the set during the number and noticed that many were actually crying. He recalled, "I suddenly realized that they were all real refugees."
Play La Marseillaise. Play it.
I'm reading from Alan K. Rohde's biography of Michael Curtiz. I'm just going to skip through here the rest of it. It's a really great book that you should pick up. And I'm just going to skip up here to a latter part where, even though Curtiz consistently credited Hal Wallace for his most endearing success, Casablanca never would have been what it became without Curtiz's brilliance. Jack Warner clearly agreed as he extended Curtiz's contract and anointed Julius and Philip Epstein producers. A sequel with the working title of Brazzaville was contemplated in spring 1943. Curtiz was assigned to direct, and a synopsis was written with a prospective cast that included Geraldine Fitzgerald and Sidney Greenstreet. The project quietly died. There was also the notion of a companion film starring Bogart and Anne Sheridan. Instead, audiences got The Conspirators, 1944, a wartime potboiler directed by Jean Neglusio and starring Hedy Lamarr, accompanied by the usual suspects, Hindred, Laurie, and Greenstreet. Curtiz began directing his next film for After Casablanca, premiered in November of 1927 of that year. His next pair of films would remain a thematic step with the war. One would become its most controversial, and the other his biggest box office success. And that's, of course, Mission to Moscow and This is the Army, based on the Irving Berlin song. Once again, I've been reading here. Oh, here, let's finish off the movie here.
Might be a good idea for you to disappear from Casablanca for a while. There's a free French garrison over at Brazzaville. I could be induced to arrange a passage.
My letter of transit? I could use a trip. But it doesn't make any difference about our bet. You still owe me 10,000 francs.
And that 10,000 francs should pay our expenses.
Our expenses?
Mm-hmm.
Louis, I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Yes, in our celebration of Bastille Day here, we're playing some excerpts from the movie Casablanca. This is Fortunato here on Gremlin Time. Just didn't quite have anything together for this month, so I thought I'd read a book that I was kind of going through on my own here. And so I've just read the chapter of on the production of Casablanca in Alan K. Rohde's biography of the great director Michael Curtiz. It's a really great book, and it is published by University Press of Kentucky, and it's about all sorts of Hollywood movies. I mean, he directed Elvis, he directed Faye Ray, and then some horror movies, and one of the best Philo Vance movies of all time. And that's just scratching the surface. So thanks for listening. We'll be back again next month with more Gremlin Time. Stay tuned for Joe Woods, who's ready to take you to some faraway places. Thanks for listening. Thank you.
KBOO Portland.